world and what our purpose is in the world. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? And that's very relevant, especially for today's topic and my guest who I'll be introducing in just a few minutes, because today's topic is gay marriage, why it matters. And I really acknowledge the fact that I'm able to be on a radio show in the middle of a Saturday afternoon talking about a topic like this and have the support of KXAM in doing what I feel is the right thing to do. Now, in 1996, some people talk about quickie divorces. Well, I had a quickie ordination. I was asked by a heterosexual couple to officiate their wedding because they've heard me speak, unfortunately, at too many memorials during the years of the peak of the AIDS epidemic in terms of our community. And the issue was, I really wanted to do this. And luckily, I remembered about the Universal Life Church. And within a month, I was ordained and legally was able to officiate at a heterosexual wedding ceremony. Just a few months later, I was called by a guy I had not heard from in years. And when he and his male partner decided to do a commitment ceremony, my name came to his mind and they called and they did this. And I actually want to open today's show by reading the convocation from the ceremony for Jim and Dan in June 15th, 1996. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here to what? These words traditionally go on to tell everyone why we are here. But look at this couple. Some would say that this is not a traditional wedding couple and that this is not your traditional wedding. In some ways, these people would be correct, but not for the reasons they might give. Many traditional marriages include two people who stand before their witnesses, fearful, questioning, and shaking at their knees, wondering if this will last, if they are really in love, if they are really loved, are they doing the right thing? Maybe some of you have had that kind of wedding. Traditional couples see this moment as a beginning of a relationship or a new form of their relationship. Traditional relationships are thought of today as time-limited and disposable in the minds of many who take this step of public commitment. This couple who stands before all of us today probably would not even be considered traditional within some gay and lesbian circles. Some in this community think of same-sex weddings, commitment ceremonies, holy unions, or whatever you want to call this, as a political statement, as an act of self-empowerment. Often this comes from a place of anger and a statement to society that we will be seen as the same as everyone else, or maybe they need to prove to society that their difference is most important. Tradition is important. Jim and Dan are probably two of the most traditional people I have ever met. This is probably the most traditional wedding ceremony I have ever had the privilege of attending. The tradition here is that these are two people who love one another and have no doubts about that. Jim and Dan are a couple who have devoted the last 5 years of their lives to being sure of the commitment they make before us today. They are sure because they made their commitment years ago and have done everything in their power to work together, play together, live together, and feel together. They have loved together and sometimes fought together, but they are here today in the presence of all of you who mean so much to them to declare that they are together. Love is the tradition we honor here today. This ceremony is not a beginning of a new phase in Dan and Jim's lives. It is not an excuse to have a party, but a reason to celebrate. They have demonstrated through their love and devotion to their love for themselves and for one another that this relationship is to be celebrated. What better way to do this than to include in this celebration those who, over the last 5 years and for some of you throughout their lives, have loved them and supported them unconditionally? Well, maybe with some conditions. Jim and Dan have asked me to welcome you and to let you know that you are the reason that they know about love. The family, the friends who gather, and friends who are their extended family have been their teacher's guide and part of the glue that has made this relationship and inspired this relationship to succeed and blossom into what you all know it to be. This is a holy relationship. It is based on a belief that there is a power greater than all of us, a spirit that breathes new life into their love in every breath. This spirit is greater than all of us because it is in all of us equally. Jim and Dan are the example and personification of what is possible when we hold on to our connection with spirit, with love. With this knowledge and understanding, we are gathered here in the presence of this great spirit and of this company to celebrate Jim and Dan's love for one another and to bear witness to the transforming power of love. It felt very important for me to start today's show with that statement, with an essence of what that ceremony and the commitment that those two men were making to one another was all about, and that's what we're talking about today. Gay marriage, why it matters. And my guest today is someone who is truly inspiring to me when I first heard him speak at the Lesbian and Gay Psychotherapists Association of Southern California's annual conference back in June. And he has been instrumental in working as a California State Assemblyman from the 13th District in San Francisco, in working on issues that help his entire district, as well as the whole state of California in many areas. But most recently, he helped spearhead, after a number of years of it not passing, the bill that would have allowed gay marriage in the state of California without a court ordering them to do so. And it passed the state assembly because of Assemblyman Mark Leno and others. But it also got through the Senate and went to the desk of California Governor Schwarzenegger, who actually in the past has spoken out in favor of gay marriage, as I understand it, but he vetoed this bill. So without further ado, I really want to get into the meat of today's show and introduce all of you to the California State Assemblyman from the 13th District of California, Assemblyman Mark Leno. Assemblyman Leno, welcome to the show today.
Thank you, Stuart. It's good to be with you.
And I also know that I think it's next Saturday you will be the keynote speaker for the Arizona Stonewall Democrats. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And
I'm looking forward to coming to your town.
You'll be in Phoenix speaking, so people
That's
can
right.
go listen to you in person. Now, what was your reaction to what I just read to open the show?
Well, I think you framed the issue very well. This is about two individuals deciding to share their lives together and why government would want to interfere with the most intimate and personal decision-making process any human beings engage in is a perfect question to be posing, especially for those who talk about smaller government. Why is our government interfering in matters of the heart and soul? And so as we move forward, the issue of marriage equality, and I don't speak of it in terms of gay marriage. There isn't gay or straight marriage. It's just marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a marriage license issued over the desk of a county clerk. Nothing could be more bureaucratic. California law for 150 years has defined marriage as a civil contract. We included wording in our bill that said very clearly that no minister, priest, rabbi, or any religious institution which does not recognize nor wish to solemnize these marriages would be required to do so. So if those religious institutions which don't recognize these marriages don't want to, they don't have to. That's their First Amendment right of freedom of religion. But we have a equal protection clause in our California state constitution, and it states very clearly and simply that a citizen or class of citizen may not be granted privileges not granted on the same terms to all citizens. So if government is going to get into the business of issuing marriage licenses, then they can only provide them to one citizen or class of citizen if they provide them to all citizens.
That's right. So that's equal protection, basically.
That's right.
Okay. So There's a book that you quoted from at the conference where I first met you that I actually devoured when I finally got a copy of it, called Why Marriage Matters, by Evan Wolfson.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the book, he says marriage is also a social statement, preeminently describing and defining a person's relationships and place in society. Marital status, along with what we do for a living, is often one of the first pieces of information we give to others about ourselves. It is so important, in fact, that most married people wear a symbol of their marriage on their hand. So, how is marriage, in terms of a social statement, why is it getting such an uproar, and why such resistance from so many aspects of our society?
Well, the resistance is melting, and we see it happening rather quickly. In the past 17 months since marriage licenses have been legally issued to committed same-sex couples in the state of Massachusetts, we've seen popular support dramatically shift from just 42% prior to May of 2004 to 60% today.
Is that nationwide or just in California?
That's in Massachusetts in the past 17 months since marriage licenses have been issued there.
Uh-huh.
A very dramatic swing in support of marriage equality in a very short period of time on a very debated issue. And you have to ask, why is that happening? And, of course, the answer is that the fear-mongering of our opposition, that the sky will fall and civilization as we know it will come to an end, and the heterosexual couple next door will find their marriage in disrepair as a result of the two women down the block getting a marriage license. None of that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so people shrug their shoulders and say, well, I don't care. In fact, why are we wasting so much time on this issue when my kids still can't get a decent public education? I can't afford my parents' pharmaceutical drugs. Our transportation system is in complete disrepair. There are blackouts, and the water's not safe to drink. Why aren't our elected officials dealing with the real issues of the day?
Okay, so, again, why aren't they? Let's get to the basis of this. I mean, what scares people so much about this?
Well, it's my belief that people really aren't all that frightened of this. It is elected leaders for their own political purposes using the issue of marriage equality to divide and conquer for their own benefit.
Mm-hmm.
They're called wedge issues. We've seen elected officials use these issues in the past. We certainly saw in a very shameful fashion the President of the United States using it for his own purposes of reelection last year. And it's a very unfortunate fact of life. But I think forces of good and righteousness do finally prevail, and that's why our opposition is getting more adamant as we get ever closer to our victory of equality.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what was really interesting, and well, one of many things that was interesting in the last presidential election is how much he used that issue, and as soon as the election was over, how quickly the idea of a constitutional amendment defining marriage got dropped by him.
Of course. And
so,
isn't it just heartbreaking to look back last summer and realize that the U.S. Senate spent five full days debating the issue of marriage equality, attempting to move forward a federal marriage amendment, placing into the United States Constitution for the first time discriminatory wording by limiting the definition of marriage. Five full days of debate when they knew going in they did not have sufficient votes to move it forward, and after 5 days of debate, they still did not have the votes to move it forward. Meanwhile, they knew that the levees in New Orleans were in a very compromised position. They could have used that time to protect human life and to protect property, and they ignored all of it. With fair warning, they had the reports that showed that should a hurricane hit the Gulf Coast, these things could happen, and they turned their backs on the lives of millions of people to waste their time debating who among us in this society shall be treated as first-class citizens and what other tax-paying, law-abiding adult citizen, she'll be given second-class citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great sadness that our great democracy in this country is being so abused by such partisan individuals.
Well, there are many arguments against the issue of marriage equality. I want to go through a number of them, actually, and let's talk about them. And I want to remind my listeners that this is a live call-in show. And if any of you have some questions or comments, whether you disagree or agree with the premise that we're putting out there, the number in the Phoenix area is area code 480-949-1310. That's 949-1310. And if you're listening from outside the Phoenix area via the Internet, as I know a number of you are because I hear from you from time to time, it's the same number. It's a toll call for you, 480-949-1310. And we'd love to have your input on today's show. So when we hear about people arguing against it, I often hear about two things. Number one is the religious and spiritual aspects of marriage equality, and the other thing I often hear is the civil rights issue, that this is not equal to women's rights, racial equality, and other things like this. Let's start with the religious and spiritual issues that are put out there, the arguments that are there, that first of all, that this is the way marriage has been for thousands of years, and that it's a sacrilege to try and change it at this point, and that it's against the will of God. What do you say to that?
Well, first and foremost, when people say they want to go back to or hold on to or they're defending the traditional definition of marriage, I would have to ask them, how far back do they want to go?
Mm-hmm.
150 years ago in this country, marriage was defined quite differently than it is today. It was really defined as a union of economic interests. In fact, up until the mid-19th century, women could not own property or sign contracts independent of their husbands because they were literally and legally the property of their husband, as was their labor the property of their husband. So if we are talking about a traditional definition of marriage, shall we go back 150, 200 years, and women will have no rights whatsoever? They're literally and legally the property of their husbands. They cannot vote. Is that what we're talking about?
And most of them couldn't even choose who they were going to marry.
Exactly. So I don't think anyone wants to go back to that definition of marriage. And, of course, when that law was changed and women were finally allowed to own property and sign contracts independent of their husbands and no longer to be their husband's legal property, the proponents of the status quo, the opponents of making that change, use the same arguments they're using today. If you do this, the sky will fall. Civilization as we know it will come to an end. And, of course, in many cases, in many ways, it has. And all for the better, because we're slowly, slowly evolving to make sure that all of our citizens, all of our men, all of our women, of every and any ethnicity, and finally, of any sexual orientation, will be provided full protection under the law, will be treated as first-class citizens. And we recognize that there are still some people who think that women shouldn't have the right to vote, that women should be the property of their husbands, that there should not be interracial marriage, that we should have laws prohibiting that. There are all sorts of people who think in very different ways, and we respect that. I respect that. In fact, I will fight to the end for anyone from a religious point of view or any other point of view to disagree with me on the issue of marriage equality and have their own point of view. But I would point out in particular, if they're approaching this from a religious argument, that we don't live in a theocracy in this country. Of course, there are those who believe we do live in a theocracy, but in fact, this is a democracy. And so we don't base our laws and the creation of our laws and the creation of our public policy on any one holy book, whether it's the Bible, the Quran, or the Torah. We base our laws on the holy books of our democracy, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence. So we recognize there are diverse opinions in a diverse culture, such as the American culture, but there's a foundation stone of our democracy in our Constitution that all men and women are created equal and have been provided inalienable rights by their creator, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
And
the
I think even
that
if we
the
go...
government would come in and tell you who you may and may not love if you want to get a marriage license is really very un-American.
Well, but even if we go back further than 150 years, I mean, Evan Wolfson in his book Why Marriage Matters actually has a couple of sections where he deals biblically, and without wanting to get into a lot of it, I mean, he quotes from Genesis that marriage shall consist of a union between one man and one or more women.
Of course.
And he quotes from Deuteronomy, a marriage shall be considered valid only if the wife is a virgin. If the wife is not a virgin, she shall be executed. And
stoned to death, in fact.
And that in Genesis, again, he says marriage of a believer and a non-believer shall be forbidden.
Right.
You know, it's that old debate about if you're going to be living technically through these books that we're talking about, how do you pick and choose which ones other than the ones that are more supportive of the point of view you're trying to make as opposed to ignoring the ones that I just quoted.
Exactly.
So
we've seen throughout history, and we see it happening today around the world, wars being fought over differences of opinion, of interpretation of one holy book or another holy book.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the genius of our founding fathers, that we have a separation of church and state, that no particular religion dominates the lawmaking of this country. We respect everyone's right to their own religious belief. We have freedom of religion in this country, but we don't let any one religion or belief dominate anybody else's, that this is a democracy of and for and by the people. So I believe, in particular, because we included in our legislation the right of any religious institution not to recognize these marriages, that the religious argument really has no substance. Recognize today that the Catholic Church does not recognize civil divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So be it.
Which
Catholics
means that they don't recognize the subsequent marriages after the divorce.
That's right. And that's the other point. And we're here to say, Catholic Church, you don't want to recognize civil marriage for same-sex couples. You don't have to, just
mm-hmm.
as you don't recognize civil divorce or the marriages that follow those civil divorces. But our society will allow individuals take responsibility for their own lives. You know, the values of our marriage equality bill are conservative values. We're talking about personal responsibility, commitment, monogamy, family, and love. Those are conservative values.
Mm-hmm. Now, the issue of procreation, because that's thrown out there all the time. You know, the purpose of marriage is to have children, and so to those people who are arguing against it, it's the issue of procreation, that gays and lesbians can't have children in the way God meant them to have children, that they throw that out, and that's the other reason. So what do you say to that argument?
Well, that also has no substance to it either. The Superior Court, which ruled that the current definition of marriage in California law is unconstitutional, now that's being appealed to the appellate court level and will finally make its way to the California Supreme Court, but there have been three state Supreme Courts in this country which have dealt with the constitutional issue of denying marriage licenses to committed same-sex couples. All three of those high courts have ruled that there is no constitutional basis for the denial of these marriage licenses, but in that ruling at the Superior Court level, the judge said one need not be married to have children, and one need not have children to be married.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's really about procreation, then are we going to deny marriage licenses to those couples who are not physically able because one of the other of the couple in a heterosexual pairing is sterile or unable to procreate? Are we going to deny marriage licenses to couples who wish to get married beyond childbearing years? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize that marriage is not defined by whether there will be children as a result of that union. It may happen, it may not happen, but that is not how we decide who can get married.
Or just people who choose not to be parents and who choose to get married and make that commitment, but, you know, are just not seeing children as part of that premise.
Of course. We don't have government dictating that to heterosexual people. They should not be dictating that to homosexual people. And, again, that argument falls completely flat.
Mm-hmm. Now, the next one is the effect that same-sex relationships have on children. I mean, even though I know as a psychotherapist that the studies and statistics, you know, do not support the arguments that it causes undue harm or any kind
of course,
other harm to children in these relationships, it's still one of the things you see thrown out there all the time. What do you say to something like that?
It's more fear-mongering.
Mm-hmm.
We know every study, and you know it better than I as a psychologist, but the psychiatric associations and the psychological associations, the American Medical Association, every medical related association which is familiar with these issues and studies that they have themselves conducted state that the gender of parents does not affect the successful rearing of children. What produces successful, stable, productive citizens is a family which is secure and loving. When children have security in their home, and when they have love in their home, they're more likely to succeed, have higher self-esteem, and do well in life, and be able to share love themselves. Of course, if you wanted to look at all of the heterosexual families from which all of the gay and lesbian people of this country come, most of us, you can't make a point. And what about all of the unfortunate, dysfunctional, alcohol-ridden, heterosexual families that are producing children?
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the sexual orientation or the gender of the parents. It's how healthy the family situation is. And if there's security and if there's love, children will thrive. And with regard to the legal aspects of this question, at least in California, we've dealt with this long ago. And there is no prohibition for same-sex couples either being adoptive parents or foster parents in California. And just recently, this past summer, we've had three California Supreme Court rulings which stated very clearly that same-sex couples have the same responsibilities and obligations to the children that they bring into their lives while they're together, just as heterosexual couples. So with regard to the rights and benefits, as well as to the responsibilities and obligations, California's law and California's Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that there is no difference between a same-sex or different-sex couple.
Well, how do you deal with, like, the state of Florida that will allow gay couples to be foster parents but not allow them to adopt children?
Again, it's all a process of evolution. Unfortunately, there will be setbacks. There will be those politicians who will use a subject matter that may be less familiar or, as a result of the lack of familiarity, a little more frightening to their constituents and use it to their political advantage. This is called scapegoating. We've seen it done to ethnic minorities. We've seen it done to religious minorities. As a Jewish man, I'm certainly well aware of how Jews have been scapegoated in the past. In fact, so many of the same arguments being used against homosexuals today have been used against Jews in the past, that it's dangerous to have your children around them, and that these people spread disease, and that they can't be trusted, that they're dangerous. This is called scapegoating, when you don't want to take responsibility for your own lack of leadership or your own inability to provide for your constituents. Elected officials will scapegoat and blame it on other people. That's what's going on in this country today.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the scapegoating is certainly something that's clear and evident to many people. And you're right about the religious prejudice, and not just with Jews, but with a lot of religious minorities in this country, and I do believe it's going on with Muslims today.
We see it happen every day.
Yeah, but you also then have the comparison with this, with the racial civil rights movement. And like you said earlier, a lot of the same arguments used then against giving blacks basic civil rights are being used now in this one. And yet there are people within the civil rights movement that are saying we shouldn't be comparing the two, and there are others within the African American civil rights movement that are saying, yes, it's totally the same, and there is the same oppression going on, and we need to stand together. You know, what do you say to that issue?
Well, I would just point out that Coretta Scott King, the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King, is in full support of marriage equality, says her husband would have been in full support of marriage equality, that this is a civil rights issue. The executive director of the National NAACP is in support of marriage equality and has been for decades. In California, as we were moving our marriage equality bill forward this past summer, every major civil rights organization in the state embraced this as a civil rights issue and joined in support of our bill. And I'm talking about the California chapter of the NAACP. I'm talking about the United Farm Workers and the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, Chinese for Affirmative Action, the Asian Law Caucus, the National Organization of Women, the Anti-Defamation League. Every civil rights organization joined us because this is a civil rights battle.
You know, I'm 55 years old, and I came out while I was in college in 1970. Like, 69 was Stonewall, and it's just amazing to me in such a short period of time that, you know, we went from not even being recognized as a group to actually dealing with issues of marriage equality within my own lifetime. Why would you think that this has progressed as quickly as it has when so many other movements have taken so long? Or do you feel this hasn't been a quick process?
Well, you're right. It is all perspective. Sometimes it appears that we've moved very quickly. At other times, it's been torturously slow.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be of the same age, and I came out at the same time. I consider myself a Stonewall baby, having come out in 1969 when I was just starting college. And for years, of course, we were told that homosexuality was an illness, that homosexuals are unable to commit themselves to one another. They don't have the ability to form stable and loving relationships, and that we were doomed to be unable to find love and commitment in our lives. Now that we have found love and commitment in our lives, we're told you can't have a marriage life.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who want to cause trouble and those who want to be narrow-minded and those who want to hold on to a limited understanding of society and of humanity, they will continue to do so. But what's exciting and heartening about the United States, I believe, is the fair-mindedness and the good-heartedness of people. And I can't tell you how many people I know from one-on-one experiences, but also just to see the poll numbers shift, that when people understand the real pain and the real suffering that is caused by the iniquity in the current law, they come over to our side. No one is learning more about the subject and going in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
No one is moving in that direction. But when people understand that, in fact, I had the great honor and privilege of marrying a male couple who have been together 51 years. I married them at City Hall in San Francisco last February. They were very young when they met. One was 15, one was 17, so they were in their late 60s when I married them after being together 51 years.
Wow.
Unexpectedly, the younger member died just last year of a heart attack, and the surviving member, who's a gentleman about 69 years old, of course, in very deep grief and mourning, having lost his life partner of 51 years, because they were not married, because the law denied them a marriage license, the surviving partner could not access the pension benefits of his departed life mate. He could not access the Social Security benefits of his lifetime mate, even though they had both paid into Social Security taxes their entire working life. And because he was denied those benefits, he could no longer afford the apartment that they had lived together in for 35 years, and
wow,
in the midst of his grief and mourning, lost his home and would be homeless today if it weren't for the generous reception that he received from a friend in his community. So people understand that that's just wrong.
Yeah.
Why are we doing that to our seniors who have played by the rules, paid their taxes, been law-abiding, loving, committed people their entire lives, and we're going to kick them out of their homes and deny them benefits even though they paid into the tax system all this time? People know that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
People viscerally react to that. That's un-American. And when people learn that kind of story, they realize there's no problem with allowing marriage licenses for same-sex couples. In fact, it's the right thing to do.
Right. I want to get back to a minute to something that you said just a little bit ago in terms of the fact that many people believe that gays and lesbians can't stay in long-term relationships and that they can't handle commitment and that, you know, a lot of other arguments around that. As a therapist, something that is very clear that I don't hear that comes up very often is there's a reason historically why long-term relationships like what you just described is something we're only now beginning to see, and that is even in the 70s and 80s, it was still very difficult for a lot of people in a lot of areas of this country, even in liberal areas, to come out of the closet, to be who they are, to feel comfortable with who they are. There was no sense of acceptance and community for many of them. So the whole idea of the only way they could satisfy their natural desires for contact with same sex was strictly only through sexual contact, and it had to be anonymous and it had to be short term, and they had to move on because God forbid anybody should recognize the fact that they're with the same person for a long period of time. And I believe that that started to change obviously in the 80s, and my personal belief is that the AIDS epidemic actually got a lot of people thinking about commitment and relationships and the losses that we were all experiencing and the importance of holding on to something that was connected from the heart and having continuity in our lives. And I really think that, you know, with all the horrors of the AIDS epidemic, it also had a residue of people really, gays and lesbians, bisexuals, transgenders, really examining what commitment and long-term relationship is about and monogamy is about and staying true to being there for somebody who may be sick or, you know, through better or worse, you know, that sort of attitude. So I think that what we're seeing now, and I think a lot of other therapists will say, there are so many more gays and lesbians entering couples counseling because of that desire for commitment and continuity and love and developing better communication skills and all those things. I think we're seeing that now because this is so openly discussed and because that even teenagers have an easier time in some areas coming out of the closet.
Without a doubt, and in fact, when you think of all of the hardships that same-sex couples have had to deal with over the years, all the negative messages that young gay and lesbian individuals have had to rebuff and deal with through therapy and other means, and just through triumph of self, it's amazing that same-sex couples get together and stay together at all.
I agree. You know, there's so much working against them.
So much working against them.
From that commitment ceremony, or wedding ceremony, to me it was truly a wedding ceremony, that I read from at the beginning. I remember that both Jim and Dan had gay brothers who stood up for them as their best men. And their parents and step-parents on both sides attended this, and there were literally in their backyard a couple hundred people witnessing this and celebrating it. And I remember after the ceremony, one of their stepfathers coming up to me with tears streaming down his face. And he said, I never understood why they were doing this until I was here witnessing it. And he said, I've never experienced as beautifully stated a wedding and as beautifully demonstrated in the ceremony what their relationship is really about. He said, I will never question this again.
That's a great story to hear. And again, it just comes down to familiarity. when people understand that we're just talking about matters of the human heart, and that love and matters of the heart certainly have very little to do with gender or sexual orientation, that we're all human beings. You know, for years as an activist involved with the issue of civil rights for the LGBT community and an activist for marriage equality, I always was interested in the bottom line, the rights, the benefits, the privileges, as well as the responsibilities and obligations of marriage for myself and my community, but I wasn't so certain that we needed to fight a war over a word. But it was after the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court decision of November 2003 that my heart and mind were changed forever. That high court, as did the High Court of Hawaii and Vermont, stated that there is no constitutional basis for this discrimination, and they went on to say that our nation's history teaches us that separate is seldom, if ever, equal.
Right.
But they went on to say something even more powerful, which changed the way I looked at this, because I'd never seen it in that particular perspective. They went on to say that the only remedy to this identified discrimination is marriage and marriage alone. They said that no parallel constructs such as civil unions or domestic partnerships would do because, they said, and this is the words of these four heterosexual justices, they said, anything short of marriage would perpetuate a destructive stereotype that suggests that there is something inherently inferior and unstable about the way same-sex couples love. And Stuart, I'd never thought about it like that before.
Uh-huh.
When you step back a few feet, I would challenge you or your listeners to tell me, what's the one thing all of us human beings walking this planet have in common, irrespective of our race, creed, color, religion, nation of origin, language that we speak, sexual orientation, gender identity, the one thing we all have in common, the thing that makes us human beings, is our ability to love.
Mm-hmm.
And our desire to love another human being in an intimate and committed fashion. That's our common humanity. And if we construct laws that say some people love better than other people, we're saying that some of us aren't quite human.
Or that some people's love is more valuable than others.
That as well.
Mm-hmm.
That as well. So when I realized the words of those justices and looked at it from that perspective, I thought, I am quite prepared to fight a war over a word, because that word means everything.
Mm-hmm. About a few weeks ago, actually, I was very honored to be the recipient of the 6th Annual Community Service Award that the Lesbian and Gay Psychotherapy Association of Southern California handed out. That was
congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I had family and friends come in from out of town for this, and it was really one of the best days of my life. And in my acceptance speech, I identified that I was thanking my family, and I'm going to read this briefly here. I want to start with those closest, my family. Traveling from near and far, I am warmed by their presence. My mother, Edith, is here with her domestic partner, Tony. Besides being an amazing and at times exasperating neurotic Jewish mother, she has also been a role model of caring for others. Her relationship with Tony is an inspiration that love can be found in the 80s. I do not mean the disco time. I mean it has been comforting and inspiring to see her meet a wonderful partner at an age when most are closing up shop. My older brother Mark is here with his domestic partner, Joe. She is an inspiration of how love can conquer the exasperating experience of living with someone with untreated ADD, and Mark has always been my role model of living one's dream even when others think you are crazy. My younger brother David is here with his domestic partner, Cheryl. Among other things, their relationship is a testament of time. Junior high school sweethearts who found each other again as David was divorcing found that love never dies and has come home to roost again after 40 years. My dad Julius and my stepmom Zena have been married for 30 years and demonstrate a devotion that rivals any love story. And then I wrote, to get political here briefly, here are four couples who love and care for each other. One couple chose the path of marriage. The other three love and care for each other and choose to commit to each other in a different form. The difference, as we all know, is that they have a choice. As gay and lesbian people, we do not. I pray that we see the day soon when LGBT relationships can be recognized as legally legitimate, even though we all know that it is up to us to honor the legitimacy of our relationship that our relationships represent on an intimate, emotional, and spiritual level.
Very beautiful. And very beautiful.
That really says it all. It's about the fact that heterosexuals have a choice in terms of how they structure their relationship, legally or otherwise. And while we have that spiritual choice and the innate emotional choice of how we honor and define our relationships, we are not allowed a choice that everyone else is being allowed.
And in that denial, same-sex couples are denied respect, dignity, and validation.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's an inhumane thing to do to a fellow human being.
Right. Now, we have about 8 minutes left here on the show today, and I want to talk about, I know that, like I said earlier on, you're going to be speaking next Saturday on the 29th at the Arizona Stonewall Democratic annual awards dinner, if I understand that correctly.
I think so.
And that is in Phoenix. And why are you leaving your state to do this talk? I mean, why have you been invited? I mean, I know you work hard in the state of California, and God bless you for that. But your voice is out there beyond the confines of California. Why are you doing this?
Well, as to why I've been invited, I would probably suggest that you ask those who extended the invitation, but I
okay.
can imagine that given that the legislative success we had with our marriage equality bill here in California this past year, being the first of its kind in this nation's history, that it is of interest to those beyond the borders of California. And clearly this is a nationally debated issue. It's about civil rights. It's about fulfilling the great promise of our democracy here in this country, and so I'm very eager to share the story of our legislative success when those who may be interested express their interest. So I think that's probably why the invitation was sent, and as I say, I'm happy to talk about it if anyone's interested in listening.
And if anybody's interested in attending the event, I know that there are tickets left, and I would invite you to go to the website for the Arizona Stonewall Democratic Club, and their website is AZ, as in Arizona, StonewallDems.com, AZStonewallDems.com, and like I said, it's on Saturday, October 29th, which is next Saturday night. It's the 5th annual leadership dinner. And I really, you know, recommend people go to support the Arizona Stonewall Democratic Club, but also to hear Mark Assemblyman Leno in person. You were great. I mean, we've had a number of keynotes at the Gay and Lesbian Psychotherapists Association in the past. Many of them have been very moving, but you speak from the heart, and that really brought home a lot of the points that you were making. I mean, it was a very genuine and very heartfelt keynote that we received from you in June, and I really was grateful for that.
Well, I appreciate the supportive words.
And
are we going to take some calls?
I don't know if we have any. Rob, we have any calls yet?
We haven't
We haven't inspired anybody.
Okay. Well, we do know that people have been listening because, number one, when I sent out my email blast, I can't tell you how many responses I got from people. And I do know that the Stonewall Dems forwarded the announcement to their whole membership, and I know there are people out there listening. So with all this being said, one of the things that really came home to me when you spoke in June was the fact that you've been trying to get this bill through the California State Assembly for a number of years. And I know in the past you fell short, I think, like 3 votes
mm-hmm.
a year ago. How did you get those last three votes? What was it that made the difference this year that you didn't have?
Well, we had a vote on the floor of the Assembly in June, and we were three votes short. And we had the opportunity to begin the legislative process on the Senate side of the legislature, moving it through the Policy Committee to the Appropriations Committee, and then to the floor of the state Senate, and that was in late August. And we had success on the Senate floor. Of course, that was historic. Never had a legislative house ever vote in favor of marriage equality, and then returned to the Assembly for a second opportunity. And whereas in June we were looking for the bare minimum 41 votes to succeed, in September when we came back, we already had 38 votes on record in support. So now we were just looking for three. And our most immediate universe in which we were seeking those three were five abstaining Democrats. And I just want to point out that by definition, civil rights is not a partisan issue. Unfortunately, the civil rights of the LGBT community in the California state legislature is a severely partisan issue, made so by my Republican colleagues, though I believe that in time they will, of course, see the light and join us in our civil rights battle. But we were looking at the five Democrats who abstained. And so we had been talking to them, working with them throughout the summer months. A number of them represented Latino districts and were Latino or Latina themselves. And so when the United Farm Workers endorsed our marriage equality bill during the summer, that was a great support. We had the great benefit of the leadership of Dolores Huerta, who is iconic in the Hispanic community in California, as she is across the country, having formed the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez years ago, and she was helping us to lobby these members, and working with the NAACP as well and trying to convince an African-American member from Los Angeles. And then, of course, during the summer months, the parliaments and prime ministers of the nations of Spain and Canada voted in favor of marriage equality and provided marriage rights for all of the citizens throughout their country, as well as the 25th Synod of the United Church of Christ passing a resolution in support of marriage equality. The second largest city in our nation, Los Angeles, passed, and its new Latino mayor, Antonio Villaraigosa, signed a resolution in support of marriage equality. So all of this was happening in very short order. Clearly, we were now part of an international civil rights movement, and I think all of this collectively impacted the three members who, in real life profiles and courage, put politics and political considerations aside and did what they knew in their heart to be the right thing to do.
Right.
And that's how we won those last three votes.
Good. Assemblyman Leno, I really want to thank you. Our time's up for today. It's been an honor to have you on the show and an honor to know that this show will be archived and people can listen to it anytime in the future. So thank you so much for taking your time today.
It's been my pleasure, Stuart. Thank you for the invitation. I look forward to seeing you in Phoenix next week.
Okay. And I want to close with a happy birthday to Louise Hay, my friend Kathy Williams, Julie Hegeler, and Aunt Rose, who turned 96 last week. And I want to thank all of you for listening. This is Stuart Altshuler on Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM 13 in Phoenix. And I'll be back next week with another show. Thanks for listening. So